Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1936, 18-year-old Marty Glickman was one of the fastest sprinters in the country, earning him a spot on the U.S. Olympic team and a trip to the Berlin Games.
I'll never forget walking into the stadium, marching in along with my American teammates in the opening day parade.
There was Hitler on the podium with his entourage of Goering and Goebbels and Hess and Himmler and all those people. And we kind of looking up at him, and he looking down at us very sternly. And you could hear the comment run through our ranks as we walked in together. He looks just like Charlie Chaplin.
Marty Glickman may have been among the fastest runners in the country, but one thing stopped him in his tracks. On the day he was to make his Olympic debut, he and a fellow Jewish teammate were dropped from the 400-meter relay. While that story is not widely known, Marty Glickman's voice became very familiar to sports fans, particularly in New York, where he became a broadcast legend, calling games for the New York Knicks, Giants, and Jets during a 56-year career. Marty Glickman is the subject of a new HBO documentary written, produced, and directed by James Friedman. Glickman is now airing on HBO and is making its New Hampshire premiere this Sunday at Cinemagic Merrimack as part of the New Hampshire Jewish Film Festival. And the filmmaker James Friedman is on the line with us. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Virginia.
Now, you have been primarily a writer and producer. Why this subject for your first documentary?
When I was 17, I used to work for Marty Glickman. I'd go in. My brother produced his radio show in New York. And one day I went in with him, and I'm sitting in the control room, and my brother told Marty he had to go into the Army Reserves and Marty would need to find another producer. Without missing a beat, Marty pointed directly at me and said, "Jimmy can do it." And I literally turned around expecting to see another kid named Jimmy sitting there. There wasn't. And for the rest of that year, I produced his show. He taught me how to get the scores off the wire, how to write them up, how to schedule commercials, screen calls. Marty never treated me like some high school kid. He always treated me as his producer, and it gave me a professional confidence I have to this very day.
Well, you don't get jobs like that anymore, I guess.
No.
But you were aware at that time he was a broadcasting giant. Did you know anything about his past as an Olympic athlete?
No, I was so naive. I only knew about him as the New York Giant football announcer and some other things he did. And most people in New York knew him as only that because Marty never talked about the Olympics unless he was asked about it every 4 years when the Olympics occurred. And he also didn't talk about what a great athlete he was on the air like many sport broadcasters do. So people, you know, he's from that generation. It wasn't considered proper to, you know, talk about yourself. It was almost as if it was considered bragging. So people really only knew him from the air.
Well, let's set the scene as you do in the film. It's 1936. Marty Glickman is 18, Jewish, from the Bronx, attending Syracuse University, one of the best sprinters in the country, qualifies for the Olympics in the 400-meter relay. Many in the U.S. at the time were calling for a boycott of the 1936 Olympics. Was Marty concerned about going to Berlin?
Marty's opinion was very complicated, as were many Jewish athletes. And a lot of it had to do with the congregations that the Jewish athletes belonged to and what the rabbi tended to believe in. But Marty did not favor a boycott. Marty favored going to Berlin to show the world and Germans that a Jew could be just as good as any other athlete, perhaps even better. And that was his attitude going there.
The games begin. Jesse Owens wins 3 gold medals. How did the Nazi regime respond to that?
Well, they actually called the American black athletes who were dominating the track and field events, which were the marquee events of the Olympics. They actually called them black auxiliaries. And Joseph Goebbels, the Nazi minister of propaganda, referred to them as more monkey-like than human. And they felt it was a shame on the white race that, one, they were beaten by these black, great American black athletes, and two, that the white American Olympic officials even allowed them to compete.
Well, on the day of the 400-meter relay, Marty Glickman gets called into a meeting. Set this up for us. Who's at the meeting?
It was actually, there were two Jewish runners on the track team, Marty and Sam Stoller, and they were celebrating Sam Stoller's 21st birthday when the head track coach, Lawson Robertson, and the assistant head track coach, Dean Cromwell of USC, came into the meeting and announced that they had heard rumors that the Germans were hiding their best sprinters to upset the American team in the 400-meter relay. And consequently, Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller were going to be dropped from the relay team and replaced by Jesse Owens and Ralph Metcalf, who had already run in the Olympics and gotten Jesse three golds and Metcalf had gotten a silver. Now, this is an absurd argument because you can't have world-class sprinters unless they've run in races and had world-class times. So it was a ridiculous lie. The truth is the American team was favored to win this race going away. They won by 15 yards. So Lou Zamperini, one of the track runner, great track and field U.S. athletes in the film, says, you know, if Glickman and Stoller had run, we probably would have won by 14 yards. It was that absurd a situation. And basically, there are rumors that Avery Brundage, the head of the American Olympic Committee, was placating Adolf Hitler. Brundage was proven to be a Nazi sympathizer. He, along with Dean Cromwell, both later became members of America First, which did not want the U.S. to enter World War II. Mm. And so many people believe that that is what happened. Marty certainly believed that.
Well, let's hear a clip from your film, Glickman, where Marty Glickman remembers his response to this meeting.
We were shocked. Coach, you know, we're the only two Jews on the track team, Sam and I. We'll worry about that later, said Dean Cromwell. Sam was completely stunned. He didn't say a word in the meeting. I'm a brash 18-year-old kid, and I said, Coach, no matter who runs, we're going to win this race by 15 yards. At which point, Jesse spoke up and said, I've won my three gold medals. I'm tired. I've had it. Let Marty and Sam run. They deserve it. And Cromwell pointed his finger at him and said, you'll do as you're told. And in those days, black athletes did as they were told.
That is a clip from Glickman. It is a new documentary written, produced, and directed by James Friedman, who we're speaking with right now. It's about Marty Glickman, who's a legendary broadcaster, but with a very interesting past as a would-be Olympic athlete dropped from the 1936 Games because he was Jewish. James Friedman, the 1936 Olympics are remembered as this showcase or would-be showcase for the Nazis. You know, we have Leni Riefenstahl's idyllic photographs of these Aryan athletes. But is the story of Marty Glickman and Sam Stoller evidence of anti-Semitism in our own country?
Well, you know, this is a time when, Marty went to train for the Olympic trials. He was going to meet his friend Eddie O'Sullivan at the New York Athletic Club, and he shows up at the club, and the doorman says, recognized him because Marty was a famous sprinter in New York, and he said, Marty, what are you doing here? And he says, I'm meeting my buddy, Eddie O'Sullivan. He's going to help me train for the Olympic tryouts. And the doorman says, I'm sorry, the locker room's full. And Marty said, well, I just have my little gym bag. I can share Eddie's locker. And the doorman said, he's sorry. And Marty realized on the way home that the club was restricted. They didn't allow Jews at the New York Athletic Club. Hmm. And, you know, it was also an era he played football with a black teammate, Wilmuth Siddhat Singh, who was not allowed to play football south of the Mason-Dixon line against white football players. It was a very different era.
A pretty embarrassing chapter in American history. Has this been publicly acknowledged?
Yes. Marty, many years later, I think it was close to 60 years later, the head of the Olympic Committee at that time, Bill Hibble, gave Marty Glickman and posthumously Sam Stoller the Douglas MacArthur Award, which more or less was an apology for what happened. But, you know, that's an apology that's coming 60 some odd years later. You know, it's you've lived a lifetime with that. I don't really know what that meant to Marty Glickman, but I do give Bill Hibble credit for doing that.
And Marty Glickman sort of has his another lifetime of his own. He returns to Syracuse, plays pro football for a bit, and became a beloved sports broadcaster. Tell us a little bit about his style. Actually, let's hear a little bit first.
Vince Barilla has it in the corner, moves out along the sideline, over to Al McGuire at the top of the key. He drives, pulls up, jumps, and he hits.
As I saw it, I said it, and also felt it. And the feeling of it is just as important as the description of it. And you use the right phraseology. Nothing fancy. A dribble is a dribble, is a phrase they use now. He puts it on the floor. Well, for me, putting it on the floor means taking the basketball and putting it on the floor. He dribbles right-handed along the right sideline. Now you see it, right-handed dribble along the right sideline.
Before the television age, Marty Glickman was the filter, this pair of eyes for so many sports fans, and actually developed his own lexicon describing action on the court and field. What are some of the Martyisms that stick out for you?
Well, what people have to understand is Marty was literally a pioneer of sports broadcasting. He created basketball terminology 101. I mean, all the terms sportscasters are using today, doing a basketball game, the key, the lane, the midcourt stripe, and Marty's most famous one, swish. He also gave viewers, listeners, the geography of the court. Prior to Marty, as incredible as this seems, a broadcast sounded like this. You know, Jones passes to Smith, Smith passes to Friedman shoots. You didn't know where the players were on the court. Marty gave a geography to it. So it would be Smith dribbles up along the left baseline, throws a bounce pass to the top of the key to Jones. Jones throws a behind-the-back pass to the right corner to Friedman, who shoots and scores, swish. You saw the game. So it was revolutionary. And people used to say, you know, this is the era really before television. So the only way to experience sports for many New Yorkers was through Marty Glickman, who said he gave a word's eye picture. And people would say, did you see the game? He said, yeah, I saw it on radio with Marty.
Well, he's a groundbreaking sportscaster, but you also create a portrait of a humble man, a man with great gifts for interpreting how other people lived, I think. And when he retired, he'd already called 1,000 football games, 3,000 basketball games, 15,000 horse races. He's in the Basketball Hall of Fame, New York Sports Hall of Fame, Sportscasters Hall of Fame. Do you think he ever got over that experience in the 1936 Olympics?
No. When people would ask him about it, the hair on the back of his neck would come up a little bit. He would be, I think this was something that troubled him, and I think he put it so beneath the surface that he didn't realize until he went back to Berlin 50 years later, and all of this anger, he went back to was walking on the track where he should have run. And keep in mind, the Olympics in 1936 were followed by World War II, so there were no Olympics in 40 and 44. So Marty Glickman never got a chance to win his gold medal. His own daughter didn't know his story. One day, she was a teenager, and she was watching a documentary on Jesse Owens, and they referred to Marty and Sam Stoller's a story of being dropped from the relay team. And she waited for her dad to come home, and he came home, and she said, "Dad, is this all true? You've never told me this." And he said, "Come with me." And he took her upstairs, and he went to the bottom drawer of his dresser, and underneath some sweaters, he pulled out his Olympic uniform. And Nancy, his daughter, said to him, You know, when you're gone one day, that's what I want." And Nancy brought that uniform out to L.A. when I interviewed her, and I literally got chills touching it. It was very bittersweet. But I don't think he ever got over that. It didn't stop him from having an incredible career and a wonderful life. And I think that injustice, you know, allowed him to really help many other people in their lives to make sure that never happened to anyone else.
Wow, just chilling. Let's hear it from Marty Glickman himself, visiting the Olympic Stadium back in 1985.
"And suddenly, a wave of anger engulfed me. I began to curse out loud, yelling at the individuals now all dead, like Robinson and Cromwell and Brundage and all. I was actually dizzy, feeling such rage that I thought I was going to pass out. How those no-good sons of bitches could have kept an 18-year-old kid from competing in those games so long ago. And it wasn't as though it was me who was the 18-year-old kid, but how could any grown person keep a kid from competing in the games when it was his ambition to do just that?
Marty Glickman, 49 years after being pulled out of the 1936 Olympics. James Friedman, I want to thank you so much for sharing this story.
My pleasure. Thank you, Virginia.
James Friedman, writer, producer, director of the HBO documentary Glickman. It's currently airing on HBO and is making its New Hampshire premiere on Sunday as part of the New Hampshire Jewish Film Festival. There's much more on the showing and a link to watch a trailer of the film itself and to the Twitter feed and website for Glickman. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.